collaboration with Tirtha Biswas, Jim Klein, Nikki Cameron, and I'll also comment on some work in progress, which hopefully should be coming out fairly soon. So I'm going to start off talking about attempts to embed inflation into string theory, and I'll talk about how string theory motivates the construction of high derivative non-local inflationary models. Whenever you work with high derivative theories, you need to worry about the presence of ghosts or classical instabilities, so I'll talk about that in part two. In the most interesting case, you have infinitely many derivatives floating around, and you might wonder whether any sense can be made of the initial value problem in that context, so I'll talk about that in part three, and then once I've got sort of the mathematical details out of the way, I'll talk about how we actually embed inflation into these models. I'll show you what the predictions for the CMB are, and I'll focus on the most interesting prediction, which is for big non-Gaussianity. Yeah, for me, non-locality is going to be more powers of box than just one.
Okay.
So I will sort of refer to everything with high derivatives in it as non-local and sort of a, yeah. So there's been a lot of interest recently in constructing string theory models of inflation. This is something that's attracted interest from both communities, from string theorists as well as from cosmologists. And on the string theory side, the motivation is that the interface with cosmology offers a rare potential observational window into string theory physics. And on the other hand, from the perspective of a cosmologist, you have this inflationary paradigm, which has been very successful in terms of phenomenology, but which still lacks rigorous motivation from fundamental theory. And so for the cosmologist, you have this potential opportunity to address the sort of deep, outstanding conceptual problems associated with the inflationary paradigm. I don't know, where's... So there's been a lot of interest in this, and there's been a lot of progress recently in constructing string theory inflationary models, and there are a number of plausible scenarios for how this could work in the literature. There are brain, anti-brain, and D3-D7 models where the inflaton is a distance between brains in the compact space. There are models where inflation is coming from the motion of some brain down a warped throat in a flux compactification. There are models where inflation is coming from the dynamics of moduli fields, like the racetrack and the roulette model. There are models where inflation is coming from tachyonic instabilities of D-brains, and of course this list is not complete. But I think the crucial thing when you're going through this sort of model building exercise is to look for some sort of distinctly stringy features in the dynamics, or better yet, some distinctly stringy observational signatures that would allow you, at least in principle, to distinguish between string theory models of inflation and more conventional field theoretic counterparts. And for the most part, that's difficult, and part of the reason it's difficult is because in most of these examples, what people do is to use string theory to derive some low energy effective action describing the dynamics well below the string scale, and then all the inflationary predictions are made in the context of that effective action. So this is an example of a low energy field theory that's used in the literature frequently to study KKLMMT brain inflation. And of course, that's a perfectly valid approach, and I have nothing against that. But we know string theory is supposed to provide a complete description of dynamics, also up to very high energies. And so it may be interesting to try and construct inflationary models which take advantage of this sort of distinctive feature. Now, for the most part, this would sort of be a daunting proposition, because any field theory description like this would need to get supplemented by an infinite series of high-dimension operators. And of course, in general, you don't explicitly know the form of all those high-dimension operators. However, there are some examples, mostly toy models, where you really do have some sense of what the full series of high-dimension operators looks like. And one example is the action for the tachyon in open string field theory. You get something that looks like this. And you can see there are infinitely many high-dimension operators in the interaction term. And in particular, there are infinitely many powers of derivatives acting on the tachyon field, and this will be a common feature with all the models that I'll talk about. So there's a non-local field theory containing infinitely many derivatives. Yeah?
Of course, as you know, for decades, people have been talking about string cosmology,
yeah.
Which I didn't quite believe because they have not been able to come up with an infinite structure, let alone frequent drops of all things. And it was confirmed by something like Berlin, maybe,
Well, many of them are fairly recent, but the The level at which I'm going to describe this is not a fully rigorous string theory compactification. So my perspective on this is just going to take this action as a starting point, and I'm not going to worry about modulized stabilization. I'm not going to worry about the background. Okay. I'm just going to couple this to Einstein gravity.
So in other words, this is sort of an intermediate stage compared to what was known before, which you showed in a couple of slides ago. That is a very low energy limit for string theory.
Yeah.
And this is sort of an improvement in the direction towards string theory, can we understand?
Well, the argument that the way I would phrase this is in that sort of low energy effective field theory picture, you may have the calculation under better control, but there's nothing distinctively stringy about it, and so some sort of small step in the direction of being more completely stringy would be there.
Take this.
Yeah. But it's a toy model, of course. No one's going to construe this as a realistic description of the universe.
But so the question is that, are there work that connects whatever they start out in string theory and coming down to this form of the Hilbert-Lagrangian, sort of like an intermediate?
This one, or are you talking about more the KKL energy?
Like we know. Okay.
Yeah. No, this is derived from SFT in a level truncation. So this is string field theory in a level truncation. So strictly, this is a 26-dimensional bosonic action.
Yeah.
Sure, yeah, that's, yeah. More phenomenologically, I can just consider a general, yeah.
You don't need separations.
Yeah, I'm just trying to motivate why you might want to write down an action like this from string theory. But you don't need the full 10-dimensional space. I can just consider this a phenomenological.
What did you do with string theory?
Yeah, if you like.
I
would say that if you're going to write down a theory that contains infinitely many high-dimension operators, you are implicitly assuming that's been derived from something that's UV complete, and string theory is an example of one
but
such thing.
It could be UV complete in itself. That's string
theory. Yeah, sure.
So what is K? I'm sorry.
K is some number. It's like it's it's 27/16 or something. It's some. It's some order one coefficient. Yeah, so the approach that I'm going to advocate then is trying to embed inflation into some sort of toy models like this where you have the full series of high-dimension operators. And, of course, the advantage of doing this over the other approach is that you might expect that the inflationary dynamics and the predictions for the CMB in a theory like this are unusual, and you might get some novel predictions. And from that, you might be able to, you might hope to extract some sort of generic features about what you can expect in UV-complete inflationary pictures. And of course, whenever there's pros, there's cons. As I said, if you demand to write down the full series of high-dimension operators, you're typically going to be working with toy models, so it'll be difficult to construct realistic scenarios where I take into account moduli stabilization, where you can identify where the standard model is supposed to be living, where you can follow the details of the dynamics of reheating. And you can at least claim to do those things in some of those other examples. So I mentioned the OSFT tachyon. Another example that I'll come back to frequently in the talk is this p-adic string theory. So the p-adic string is a toy model of the bosonic string theory tachyon. The reason this is a toy model is because the world sheet coordinates are taken to be valued in the field of p-adic numbers instead of in the field of real numbers. And it turns out that when you do this, you can compute exactly all amplitudes for the tachyonic state in this theory, and you can write down a fairly simple field theory Lagrangian which reproduces those amplitudes. And the answer that you get looks like this, and MS is a string mass, GS is a string coupling. P is a prime number that characterizes the number system that you're using on the world sheet. And although this is derived for P a prime, you can analytically continue this to other values also. Phi is a scalar representing the open string tachyon. And the thing to notice is just like the one I wrote down on the last slide, you have this E to the box type kinetic operator, which you can think about as an infinite series expansion in powers of box. So this is a non-local theory containing infinitely many derivatives. The field equation that you get also has infinitely many derivatives. So this is the Euler-Lagrange equation for the p-adic tachyon in this theory. This is kind of an interesting mathematical object in and of itself. It's an infinite order nonlinear partial differential equation. In certain cases, you can rewrite this as an integral equation, which is telling you that infinite order equations are really fundamentally different from the kinds of second order equations that you're more used to in physics. So for generic values of P, this contains the full infinite series of box corrections. But in the special limit, P goes to 1. The box squared and higher corrections all go to 0, and this collapses down to become some local equation that looks like this. And so P equals 1, you can think about as being the limit of local field theory for the p-adic string. And on the other hand, P large compared to 1 is the limit where the non-local structure is playing a very important role in the dynamics. And when I get to talk about cosmology later, we'll see that indeed this large P regime is the limit that's most interesting for cosmology.
You said something was exact. You go back two slides. What was it that was exact?
This exactly reproduces all the scattering amplitudes for the tachyon of this theory. So that's how this is derived. No. Yeah. Just tree level, yeah. It's alpha prime exact, but it's perturbed in G string. Well, it's as long as I keep G string small, I mean.
If you don't use entire functions of exponential, you can risk getting an unphysical point.
Yeah.
Which violates the entire.
Yeah, I'll talk about that.
Well, you're getting that.
Yeah.
So you'll have to use entire functions.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So a few more words about the physics of the p-adic string theory. If you set box equal to zero, you can extract the potential, and it looks like this. There's an unstable maximum, which physically corresponds to the state we have a space-filling D25 frame. And of course, you can have open strings ending on that. And the negative curvature about that maximum is telling you about the fact that the 25 frame is unstable to decay in the bosonic string theory. There's a stable minimum of the potential, which is the true vacuum of the theory. Physically, that's the state where you have no more brain and no open strings because there's nothing for them to end on. And so the process of rolling the tachyon from the unstable maximum down to the stable minimum of the theory is giving you a time-dependent description of brain decay. So this is what tachyon condensation looks like in the p-adic string theory. So in this talk, I'm going to consider studying inflation in some sort of generic class of non-local field theories of this form, where all the non-local structure is encoded in this kinetic function, f of box. And you get theories that look like this, as I mentioned, in string field theory for the tachyon, but you expect something like this for the other fields as well. I mentioned the p-adic string theory already. You can get something like this from quantizing strings on a random lattice, and there's some connection with p-adic string theory there. You can get this in certain brain world constructions, and it turns out as some kind of a low-energy effective description of unparticle dynamics. And moreover, you can get similar non-local theories, although somewhat more general, from QFT with minimal length scales and non-commutative geometry. It's not important. The unparticle is some conformal sector phenomenologists have been studying adding into the standard model. And this is sort of I was looking for more examples of things that turn out to look like this. Yeah.
So the difference is, so brain world instruction, these would not be
entire functions. Well, I guess we should ask Claudia, but it is an entire function. It's a fully resummed Taylor series, is it not?
I guess in
your case. Yeah, I'm talking about the regularized defect thing.
I just mean, if it's a brain world story, these non-trivial F of box tells you that there are extra modes in the theory, right? That those are the KK modes.
In your case, I don't. Well, I don't know.
I think what you're referring to is something else. It's not even.
What is F of box in that case?
One over one plus box.
So are you going to kind of consider the limit when in some sense box squared is not much smaller than the box itself?
Yeah.
So that is if all operators in the series become important, does it capture the whole dynamics?
The philosophy here is just to take this action seriously and solve the dynamics classically, right? I mean, so it, of course, the phenomenologically, it's only going to be interesting when the high derivative corrections are big, right? That's the regime where this is going to look different from local field theory.
So some new questions that we've been asking, some general questions. This Lagrangian in the law in our local theories.
Yeah.
Can one show that it's a generic form for almost all the string theories as you actually before this I should ask a question, what's the relation between quantum field theory and string theory? Presumably that's something that we all know, that it contains string. Well, there's string field theory that everybody's trying to get, but
this is supposed. SFT is supposed to be like an off-shell formulation of the perturbative string theory.
So from string theory to quantum field theory, and here you were talking about non-local quantum field theory. Actually, you have branches as well.
Yeah.
How are they related? These three concepts: string theory, and non-local quantum field theory.
The string field theory subsumes the perturbative string theory in some sense. It's the off-shell formulation. These non-local field theory QFT actions that you're getting are being derived from the world sheet formulation of SFT. You can put in some level truncation and compute these effective actions. I'm not an expert on how they actually do the calculation. The infinite derivative structure is expected to be generic, and this particular phi f of box phi happens to come out of these two examples.
It's very high order box.
Yeah.
Arbitrary powers of phi.
Yeah.
This any term you wrote includes arbitrary powers of box, but bilinear.
Yeah.
Why not adding also arbitrary powers of phi and arbitrary powers of box?
Because that.
You're saying.
But two. Two.
Implies that they're both important. Right?
Yeah, two reasons. First off, this is simpler. Second off, this is exactly the form that you get in all those examples. I'm not construing this thing by itself as a realistic model anyway, right? That I'm already admitting from the outset this is a toy model. So I'm trying to see qualitatively what new features come up.
Can you assume a background space time separate from this?
Yeah, I'm just going to couple this to
something that's.
I'm just coupling it to Einstein Hilbert gravity.
To some
fixed
time. FRW. Self consistently, the stress tensor of this stuff will source the expansion.
Okay, so it comes back to the same problem that is the string cosmology.
Right? Yeah.
That you assume FRW is already in place.
But again, I'm not claiming this as a fully rigorous string theory calculation. I'm claiming this as a step towards having more stringy features in your string cosmology. Yeah. That's the philosophy.
With no judgment.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah. Okay, so I'll give away the final answer right now. So I'll show you, we can embed inflation into this general class of non-local field theories, and when you do this, a number of novel features arise. First off, you can realize slow roll inflation, even when naively the potential is very steep, and this is kind of an interesting thing, I think, because it turns out that flat potentials are surprisingly difficult to obtain in realistic stringy scenarios. And better yet, this is a predictive setup when we're generically going to have a large non-Gaussianity in the CMB for this kind of model. So the focus is the cosmology, but we need to address the complications that arise when you work with high derivative theories. And so these difficulties are mostly fairly well known. You get classical instabilities or ghosts in the quantum theory that threaten unitarity. In the case where there's infinitely many derivatives, there may be difficulties in setting up the initial value problem. And so clearly any application of this kind of theory to physics, not just cosmology or whatever, needs to address fundamental issues about when non-local theories can be ghost-free and when you can make rigorous sense of the initial value problem when there are infinitely many derivatives floating around. And so before I talk about cosmology, I'll make a little detour to talk about that. So before I actually talk about the infinite order case, I want to quickly review what happens in the finite order case. So it's fairly well known that when you add, I'm going the wrong way here. There we go. Yeah. So it's fairly well known that when you add finitely many high derivative corrections to the action, you essentially always get yourself in trouble. And I'm going to illustrate this in the context of this Lee-Wick model. Lee-Wick theory is basically, it's a Klein-Gordon theory with an extra box squared correction. And I will assume, as did Lee and Wick, that the mass scale that suppresses the high dimension operator is big compared to the mass of the scalar field. And following our discussions over lunch, I should mention, for pedagogical reasons, I'm going to take this seriously. As I'm not going to treat this as a low-energy theory. I'm just going to take it seriously all the way up to and including this mass scale. So I should mention, this is not a completely ad hoc thing to do. You can add high derivative corrections like this for every field in the standard model. And it turns out that the high derivative structure makes the UV behavior of the theory better. So the Higgs mass is only logarithmically divergent, and this Lee-Wick standard model gives you a new solution to the hierarchy problem. It is apparently consistent with electroweak data, and it makes some predictions for the LHC. So this is not a completely unmotivated thing to consider.
The major problem, this is unfortunately, it's not on the archives, so nobody knows about it. But you can actually construct QED without binding linearity occasion variance.
But
anything works.
Yeah. My motivation for considering this is just pedagogical. I just want to illustrate what happens in this theory. So it's not.
Just write down marks like that.
Yeah.
It's a very specific kind of theory.
Okay.
If you don't go deep off shell in this game, yeah, instead of blocks, just try
it. Yeah, fine. The point here is I just want to illustrate where the instabilities come from in high derivative theories. I'm not trying to advocate the Lee-Wick model as a physical theory. So the equation of motion that you get is fourth order and time derivatives, so you need four initial data instead of the two that you would usually picture. The extra box squared correction in Lagrangian gives you an extra P4 term in the denominator of the propagator, so now the propagator has two poles, corresponding to the fact that this theory contains two physical states, and you can see that more explicitly by doing a partial fractions decomposition on this propagator, so you can write it as an ordinary-looking propagator for the lighter field and an almost ordinary-looking propagator for the heavy field, except that there's a crucial relative minus sign between those two terms, which is telling you that one of those two states, in this case it turns out to be the heavier state, is being propagated with wrong sign kinetic term in the Lagrangian. So the heavier field in this case is a ghost-like excitation. You can see that even more explicitly by introducing these auxiliary fields, chi1 and chi2. You get chi1 by acting on phi with some operator that projects out the ghost, and you get chi2 by acting on phi with some operator that projects out the non-ghost-like state. And when you make this ansatz, then the Lagrangian decomposes into three different pieces. You get a normal Lagrangian for chi1. You get an almost normal Lagrangian for chi2, except that there's wrong sign in front of the kinetic term, and then you get interactions between the two fields. So there's wrong sign kinetic term. And the problem with wrong sign kinetic term is that because chi2 contributes to L with the wrong sign, now it also contributes to the Hamiltonian with the wrong sign, so it carries negative energy density. The Hamiltonian is unbounded from below, and the system is unstable, so the dynamics generically drive this system to become arbitrarily excited as time goes on. So there's clearly a pathology, and I want to be clear about what kind of pathology this is. It's at the heart of it, this is really a classical problem. You can see this already at the classical level. And in fact, the field theory associated with this can be made unitary. Moreover, taking larger. It's an unstable unitary theory. I'll get there. It's when you quantize, you have a choice in the I epsilon prescription that lets you pick between. So the other thing to point out is that taking larger values of the ghost mass doesn't cause it to decouple from the theory. It actually makes things worse. If you make a positive energy excitation heavier, it decouples from the theory. But if you make a negative energy excitation heavier, it couples more strongly to the theory, because now there's more phase space for the vacuum to decay into negative energy stuff. So the only way to salvage this kind of theory is by imposing some auxiliary constraints on the dynamics, which is essentially what Kutkowski and company did for the Lee-Wick model back in '69, and they had some complicated formalism for this, but it's basically equivalent to putting future-like boundary conditions on the field chi2 that keep it from growing exponentially in the future. So this is an extremely general problem. I illustrated this with the Liwick, but it's much more general than that. It's so general that it has nothing to do with field theory at all. You can see this already for classical particle mechanics. So if you take a Lagrangian that depends on whatever coordinate and its n derivatives, the Euler-Lagrange equation is 2nth order in time derivatives, so you require 2n initial conditions to specify a solution. If you have 2n initial conditions, then you need 2n canonical coordinates in the Hamiltonian fixture, and that's n canonical positions and n conjugate momenta. And there's a theorem due to Ostrogradsky back in like the 1800s that the Hamiltonian is always unbounded from below with respect to n minus 1 of those conjugate momenta. So this is a very powerful statement, and this is why, in retrospect, for example, there's no a dot term in Newton's laws. So you can generalize that to field theory, and it's straightforward. If you have an action that depends on phi, box phi, going up to box n of phi, then generically n counts the number of poles in the propagator, because the inverse propagator is an nth order polynomial in p squared. Number of poles in the propagator is the same as the number of physical states in the theory. You need two initial data per physical state, because those are the two free coefficients that get promoted to annihilation creation operators in the quantum theory. And the number of initial data is the same as the dimension of the classical phase space. And the Ostrogradsky theorem is telling you that the finite n theory is always sick, except in the local case, n equals 1. And taking larger values of n just gives you more unstable directions and just makes things worse. And so then the question is, what about n equals infinity? Because... Well, it's sure, but I mean the point here when I'm going to put the infinite series in, the point is that I don't want to imagine this low energy effective theory of something. I want to imagine that's the complete theory.
So you're dealing with the infinity case.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're not trying to get the order reduction to get it down to the second order.
No.
Otherwise you're dead. Have to have an infinite number. Even then,
yeah. Yeah. Well, even then, it's not. Yeah, I'll get there. Yeah. Yeah. So the cases I'm actually interested in then look like this. And here, I'm not going to be considering f of box some finite order polynomial. I'm interested in f of box, a full like transcendental function. The new and novel thing that comes up here is that the equation of motion that you get is infinite order. And this, as I mentioned, the infinite order equations are fundamentally different from finite order equations, even when the order is large. And so if you go back, then the stability of the theory and the number of states in the theory and is all intimately tied to the number of initial data that you need to prescribe to uniquely specify a solution. And so the crucial question that you need to address is, how many initial data do you need to specify to uniquely fix the solution of an infinite order partial differential equation? And so to answer that conclusively, you need some formal treatment of initial value problem in infinite order PDEs. And that's, if you're going to do this kind of thing, it's good to make friends with a mathematician, which is what I did. And it turns out that actually the math community has solved most of the hard parts of this problem back in the 30s and 40s. So I'm going to give a sort of schematic picture of how the data counting works. So clearly, if you're going to solve these equations, the first step is to make some sense of these function of partial derivative type operators that you have floating around. And what I've been doing implicitly in the talk up until now is expanding this into Taylor series and powers of the derivatives and just interpreting this pseudo-differential operator as this kind of an infinite series expansion. And that's certainly intuitive, although, of course, this only works when you have analytic kinetic function with infinite radius of convergence. And even in that case, it's not completely trivial to determine whether this series converges when it acts on some arbitrary function. And in fact, it turns out this is not what mathematicians typically use when they study pseudo-differential operators. Mathematicians typically work with a class of functions that admit some contour integral representation like this, which is essentially a Laplace transform. And then they define the action of this pseudo-differential operator by multiplication in the Laplace space. Oops. So this is the definition that I'm going to employ. Of course, the advantages are that this is extremely general. This works for any kind of kinetic function you can imagine. You can have poles or branch cuts or essential singularities or whatever you like. So you can simultaneously handle a huge array of different types of non-locality. Of course, whenever there's pros, there's cons. So if you do want to work with non-analytic functions in here, then especially functions with branch cuts, then the choice of contour is not immediately obvious. Moreover, the generalization to curved backgrounds is not completely trivial, although de Sitter space is the happy exception where generalizing this to curved backgrounds is trivial.
What is the key there? I mean, you said it's difficult to generalize the curved space. I'm just wondering what's the gist?
Because the argument of this is going to be covariant D'Alembertian, and it's going to depend on time. And then when you pull it inside the integral, it's not obvious what to do with the times.
So it's just dynamic space. It's not curvature.
Yeah, it's dynamic space time. That's why de Sitter is so. Yeah.
Hi, Elijah. I don't want to slow you down, but I have a couple of general questions. So, first of all, so if your f of box is it's not a Dirac function.
Mm-hmm.
Still, typically, you have some essential singularity at infinity.
The point is it's the usual thing when you do contour integrals, right? The point at infinity isn't the poles at infinity aren't included in the calculation. It's like e to the z, right?
It's very important. So this is one of my confusion. So in field theory, all the time we do contour integrals, and we assume that things fall off. We choose contours so that things fall off.
Yeah.
At infinity, but I think whenever you have these e to the box, that makes these integrals very subtle. Because, you know, it's not true that your integrand fall off.
Well, this for me.
You cannot close a contour and assume that the.
No, I'm defining this. I'm defining this with a closed contour already. I just need to count the residues.
What is the contour?
I'll get to the contour.
This what?
This is a different story. Yes. Normally, if I do normal naive field theory, I know which contour I'm choosing.
Yeah, that's. I'm getting there.
So you
please.
Have to say what the contour is.
Yeah, that's.
So I have another.
Another
question. So another way I can study whether a propagator has a ghost or not is to ask whether it has a well-defined spectral representation.
Yeah.
I don't think entire functions lead to a well-defined spectral representation.
Yeah, I need to think about how this translates into your language with the spectral representations, but
this,
I need to think about that.
This is a problem with the string theory since the early 80s.
Yeah.
Because it was discovered in the string theory exactly it's got enough that you frustration theory.
Yeah.
If you go to the cross channel, e to the minus p squared becomes e to the plus p squared, t channel.
Yeah.
So what Gross and Mendoza did in 1983-84, you have to resum the series using center point techniques in order to get good behavior in all the channels. Mm. You can't do it with specific perturbation theory. So it's already the S channel.
Mm.
So the S channel, you get e to the minus p squared, roughly speaking.
Yeah.
So everything goes out fine as far as your UV is concerned. When you do the cross channel, you have to do this resum the series.
Yeah.
But it's still an open question. People who do string theory don't know, they're usually not born at the time that this was done. These papers are not in the archives. These are ancient problems which were never resolved. It's too
far. Yeah.
But you get it.
Probably. So just so that it's clear that this isn't completely crazy, if you take C to be some infinite closed contour that encircles all poles in the integrand, and if you expand that in a Taylor series, and if you're cavalier about convergence, then you can check that this reproduces the series definition that I had earlier. So I'll refer to this sort of infinite closed contour as being sort of the natural choice of contour in this definition. However, you might want to take a more general approach to this and imagine taking the choice of contour to be part of the definition of the operator. And there's sense to that because different choices of contour are going to give you different theories with different dynamics. And this is something that in the analytic case, it may look a little bit contrived. But if we had been starting off with something that had non-analytic structure, then it would have been obvious from the outset that there was no preferred choice of contour, and that was something that you just get to pick as part of the definition of the theory.
Is pi tilde by definition the Fourier transform of pi?
No. Yeah. Laplace transform. So to give a sense of how this works, I'll just give the trivial, silly example where f of s is some analytic function with isolated zeros, and you want to solve this equation in the Laplace space. It looks like that. And the integral vanishes as long as the integrand is analytic inside the contour, which is where the choice of contour is coming up, because you can do whatever the heck you want outside the contour. You can have poles, and it won't affect the answer for this equation. So it's fairly straightforward to see that the most general function that you're allowed to write down in Laplace space has poles that are canceled by the zeros of the kinetic function. And if you go through the calculation, then you can check that the most general solution for this equation looks like a bunch of polynomials times a bunch of exponentials. And there are some free parameters implicit in these polynomials which help you to fix the initial data for this equation. And you can go through and count those, and the number of initial conditions is the same as the number of zeros in the kinetic function counted by multiplicity. So you can generalize that to some straightforward field theory. And so let's suppose the kinetic function has n zeros, then the propagator, which goes like 1 over the kinetic function, has n poles. And you can check that the most general solution then has 2n free coefficients, which you can write as the real and imaginary parts of n complex numbers in Fourier space. And so if you write it in this form, then it's clear that these are the things that turn into annihilation creation operators when you quantize. And so this describes n independent physical states.
If you have all these poles, you're going to violate the entire consequence.
Sure.
You only have one pole instead of one pole.
Yeah, I'm just trying to count the data right now.
Okay.
I'm not worrying about whether this is I'm not quantizing this yet. I'm just. And so you can prove the theorem that this kind of pole counting exhaustively counts all of the initial data. And so it's important to be clear about what's meant by initial value problem here. So there have been claims of solving the initial value problem where it's just you construct some particular solution, you count how many free parameters are in the particular solution, but you need to actually prove that this completely exhausts all solutions that you could have written down.
You don't extend the solution starts minus infinity. It's
t goes from zero to plus infinity.
Plus.
Yeah, it's Laplace transform. Yeah. And so there's. Well, I want to fix the initial data at some time and then evolve the system forward, because that's the counting that's related to how many states are in the theory, right?
But what if those things blew up?
In the cases where you have too many of them, they're going to blow up in plus infinity too. So yeah. So if that's.
It might be that you don't have as many, depending on. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to solve the classical initial value problem that I start everything on some time-like surface and then evolve it forward. Right? That's the data counting that's related to the dimension of the classical phase space. So that's how to count initial data. And then if you want to address issues of stability of the theory, then it's nice to have some sort of multi-particle decomposition similar to what I did for the Lee-Wick model. And so you can check that for a general theory that looks like this, where f of z is some arbitrary meromorphic function, if f of box has n zeros, then you can rewrite this explicitly. Having isolated zeros or isolated poles, but no branch cuts and no essential singularities, except possibly at the point of infinity. Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't. Did you ask the question about the contour mod?
I'm taking the contour to be part of the choice, part of the definition of the theory.
Oh, okay. So, yeah.
So I'm gonna imagine taking different contours.
So I have to keep harping on this, but when you say that the number of solutions is
I mean, there's this Ostrogodsky construction going back to.
Well, that's a finite number. But here you have an infinite number.
Yeah, so in the fully infinite case, the way that I would advocate building the Hamiltonian is by decomposing this into the independent states and then deriving a Hamiltonian for each of these independent fields.
But you can have a theory where you have a propagator and the entire function enumerates the propagator.
Yeah.
You have one pole.
Yep. That's right here.
Thank you.
Yeah. So you can rewrite it as a bunch of interacting field theories, and the mass spectrum of those fields is determined by the zeros of the kinetic function. These epsilon I are some constants that can be plus or minus one, depending on whether the state is ghost-like or not. And you can compute the sine of epsilon I by the residue of the propagator at the pole associated with this state. And there may be some function with no zeros, which I called gamma box, that encodes whatever residual non-locality is left over when you do this decomposition and then their interactions. And this is something you can explicitly compute. If you give me a particular kinetic function, then I can compute all these quantities. And so the stability of the ith state is then related to the sine of this. And as I said, you can compute that sine. And you can systematically figure out what every theory, which even has the potential of being ghost-free with a meromorphic kinetic function, is. And the example that's well-known is the single-pole theory, which is exactly the one that you're talking about. And the case that's somewhat less well-known is the certain multipole theories can be okay as long as the kinetic function is non-analytic in a certain way. So, that's how to determine potentially ghost-free theories. On the other hand, what if your favorite theory does have ghosts, and what do you do in that case?
If that f is exponential, then what is that exponential?
How do you mean? With
exponential? Exponential of box. So then what? Is there any point? What's going to be the next line?
Well, if it was just phi e to the box phi, without anything else, mm-hmm. Either the box has no zeros and there's no solution in that theory.
It's just
zero. Yeah. If it's e to the box times box minus m squared, then it's one pole, and decomposes into one state.
Yeah.
And so for some general complete function, you can use this Weierstrass theorem to rewrite it as some prefactor times the factors of zeros divided by the factors to give you the poles.
So you need e to the minus p squared over lambda squared over p squared minus x squared plus I.
Yeah. Yep.
Right.
Yes.
Good.
So part of the thing that I like about this sort of this analysis with the contour integrals is that it gives you some idea of how you can project out ghost-like excitations if you do want to salvage theories that have this problem. And so I've been implicitly giving this, defining this, taking C to be some infinite contour, and you might imagine just redefining the pseudo-differential operator, taking some restricted contour that excludes the unwanted poles of the propagator that are associated with the ghost-like modes. So I mentioned when I talked about Liwick, the only way to salvage those kinds of theories is by putting auxiliary constraints on the dynamics. This is just a way of putting an auxiliary constraint on the dynamics that constrains that you'd only move on some subsurface in phase space. But the thing that I like about this is that it's a way that you can do this at the level of the pseudo-differential operators that appear in the Lagrangian. It's extremely general. You can do it for the infinite order case. You can do it for non-analytic functions or what have you. And it turns out you can do this, although the way I'm describing this sounds sort of manifestly linear. You can do this at the nonlinear level as well. So I'm just going to illustrate how this works with going back to the silly example of the Liwick theory. And the question that came up the last time I was here is whether the exercised Liwick theory is just a local theory in disguise, and it's not, because basically what you're doing is just imposing some constraint on the initial value surface, but you're not changing the dynamics off that. And so to see that, then, this is what the Liwick model looks like. The kinetic function is some second-order polynomial, and so in the free theory, you have some oscillatory solutions, e to the I omega t, where the frequencies are fixed by the zeros of the kinetic function, so they look like this. And just like I said last time, the plus sign gives you the high-frequency excitations, which are ghost-like, and the minus sign gives you low-frequency positive energy states.
Do you know of the work of Carl Pinto and Phil Blenheim recent physical universities?
No, I don't.
They claimed to have solved these problems in the...
Yeah, I know Mannheim has claimed that for conformal gravity case, yeah. No, I'm not, I've never looked through it in detail, I'm not sure.
Okay.
So there is something here, I don't understand. You can't, all this can be extended for nonlinear, for nonlinear theory as well, right?
Yeah.
At least if V of phi is a nonlinear. But these masses are a function of the background field. So or that the poles, like, I imagine, if you change the background field, the poles would be rolling around the ghost like poles.
Okay, I'm just, it's a single, it's one field.
Yeah, sure.
Example
sure.
here, yeah.
But to get the propagator, you have to expand around some background, right?
Yes. I'm just one scalar field in flat space.
That's right, but it's not V of phi is a nonlinear function of phi.
Well, I can put all the free theory in this part, right? It's just a redefinition of Hilbert box. I've done that here. So here the interactions are phi cubed and higher. There's no mass.
But I'm saying masses will be a function of the background field.
Yeah, right. Yeah, okay, right. So I'm implicitly expanding around the background.
That's true. So
if you like.
When that background field changes, the poles would be moving.
Yeah, so the interpretation of this is being understood at the linear level. There are very special equations that you can solve exactly, fully non-local, fully non-linear equations that you can solve exactly, and you can check this prescription at the non-linear level in those particular cases. And in the particular cases where you know how to construct exact solutions, this works non-linearly, is the statement. I'll show you later.
I'm guessing that if the poles start moving, then the contour should start moving so that you can keep avoiding gusts.
Well, at the perturbative level, you're going to solve it around the vacuum, and then you're going to go order by order in perturbation theory. And so if you projected out the ghosts at one order, then you don't reintroduce them order by order at the perturbative level. The point is the dynamics are still different from a single derivative theory. It's a way of just putting constraints on the initial value data so that you only have two free parameters instead of four. That's all it is. It's just a...
Okay. So you still have two parameters instead of four or even higher. In the beginning, naively, without this operation,
yeah.
You would shift all these non-local things to actually a whole hierarchy of interpretations.
Yeah.
Now you can turn it into the same initial condition as you would specify in that local theory.
Yeah. So I'm trying to constrain it so that I only need two initial data, but I want to do that in such a way that I'm not just trivially making it a local theory again.
Right. But is this identical to the non-local theory?
No. No, it's not. It's identical to a subset of solutions of non-local theory.
So this is the set that's more acceptable physically.
Yeah. This is when Woodard was first pointing out these. Woodard and Elsier had a famous paper where they pointed out these issues, and this they were talking about what potentially can work and what potentially can't work. And one of the things they suggested is just redefining the theory in some way to constrain it to a naive subset of its solutions. And this is just a way of doing
string
that.
String theory doesn't do that.
Apparently not. Yeah.
He proved that string theory cannot be redefined as a local
theory. And you still have those excitations. This theory, this subset.
Well, you don't access the negative energy parts of the phase space.
You don't.
It's a constraint that keeps you from rolling off in the negative energy direction.
You don't let the ghost live. You just don't want to touch them.
Yeah, essentially. Yeah.
It's
by choice of contour. Yeah. Yeah. So this is obviously a silly thing to do for the Lee-Wick model. It's supposed to be a pedagogical example here. So if you look at that in Laplace space, then you have four poles all on the imaginary axis. You have the two poles at higher frequency associated with the ghost state, and two poles at lower frequency associated with the non-ghost state. And the sort of naive contour, the natural contour, is the big one that encircles everything. And of course, you can imagine that going to infinity in all directions. And then I'm just going to advocate rewriting it using the restricted contour. But you can still send this to infinity in all directions as long as you don't cross over the blue poles. And to see how this works, I'm just going to illustrate the effect doing a perturbative expansion around the free theory. So obviously the free solutions where you ignore the interactions, it's just e to the I omega t oscillators, and the contour redefinition just trivially turns off the higher frequency modes associated with the ghost, which is not particularly exciting. And it becomes a little more interesting when you look, when you start to include nonlinearities. And so at higher order in perturbation theory, you'll get some equation that looks like this. You'll have f of box on the second order perturbation equal to some source term where the source is constructed from first order perturbation squared. And just to illustrate how this is working, you can consider some oscillatory source just as a toy to see what the effect is. So you can solve the inhomogeneous equation using the Green's function, which is just the propagator. And on the second line, I've rewritten the propagator in that partial fractions decomposition, so you can see explicitly that there are two terms, one associated with the normal state, one associated with the ghost state, and that's the minus sign that I mentioned earlier. And the point is, I'm just trying to prove that this exercise theory is not a single derivative theory in disguise. And the point is that the second term still contributes non-trivially because the source frequency is still inside the contour, even though this pole is outside the contour. So you can you can play around with this, and you can construct the full solution if you want.
Isn't that equivalent to, normally the way you would treat these higher derivative corrections is treat them as a perturbation, like maximum indicating.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're perturbing around.
It's
order solution is the one in which you just turn it off. Essentially, you're treating this higher correction as an interaction.
It's equivalent to taking the four derivative theory and putting a constraint between phi triple dot, phi double dot, and the lower phi dots.
That would be the case, and I think that would be the case when I'm describing as well. If you treat the higher order correction as a small perturbation, then eventually your space of solution is reduced. And you're only going to continuously tend to.
Yeah.
So but that prescription only makes sense as long as the correction is small.
It
only makes physical sense. But here it's just a prescription. You're thinking that they. You're saying if you looked at the physical basis of it, if those higher derivative terms arose as sort of perturbative corrections,
yes,
keeping them perturbatively small would be the only physical thing to do. And that would result in what you're saying, I think.
Right.
One would say, okay, I got this theory, who cares where it came from? I'm going to just treat it as if it was a complete theory.
But Neil, is that a condition that in this prescription? I don't see that.
Well,
so you have a hierarchy of gradients for contribution to the higher order derivative terms.
Yeah.
For
me, this is just a constraint on the initial data. It's just.
I guess that's what Justin's question pertains. Right? Because physically, we know that, but how does that compare with your construction? Would it contain this condition that the higher derivative terms are actually getting decreasingly smaller, so we can sum it up as?
No, it doesn't. I mean, in the contour picture, I can integrate over whatever I want. That constraint is not implicit in this.
You have not mentioned anything about that.
Yeah.
I see. So you're not doing something order by order. Delta 2 phi. you're doing a perturbative.
I'm perturbing around the vacuum, but I'm not perturbing in the. I mean, the model I'm taking is just box squared, right? So it's a bit.
But it's something to check out, because that would be a very natural thing if one thinks physically.
Mm.
And if you conclude that you don't need this kind of preservative treatment, this is a more powerful method.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Well, I think, I mean, I was intending the Lee-Wick thing as a pedagogical example, right? I'm intending to do this at the fully non-local level where there's a much less trivial statement, I think.
Physically, this choice of contour, what does it mean? Does it mean that you just fix that your momentum transfer squared in certain reactions should not exceed a certain value, so you never produce this ghost?
Well, my philosophy on this had been that if the contour is part of the definition of the theory,
but
then I should define it in the way that makes it physically sensible.
Reformulation in terms of, I don't know, maybe some kind of a finding.
Yeah.
diagrams that, it would be a statement that your ghost is kinematically inaccessible, that means that you limit.
Yeah, if you like, I think.
So. And so it's difficult to try to reproduce it in the purpose. You can't sum it up and insist on I still have the infinite.
Yeah.
That's what you want. And you succeeded in coming up with a prescription.
Yeah, that's.
Okay, but I can always do the perturbation theory and check whether this is right or wrong.
Right,
in principle, I can reduce even those perturbative.
That will be very useful for physicists.
Which means that you know, his theory doesn't do that, which means that there's probably some kinematic constraints on what you
so
mean. Yeah, I think that may be true.
These two ways of measuring
condition.
Which I suspect related to the choice of the contour.
Because it's not physical.
What happens if you apply this to QED? The surface theory occasion variance.
Why am I doing this to QED? I don't know, I didn't think of the gauge invariance. You wanted
theory.
Oh, okay, no, it yeah, no, I don't know, I didn't check that. Again, the Liebig theory was not the focus here. Yeah, yes, that's fine. About what?
Well, I'm already confused the real scale.
But that was the point of having a simple, maybe it was a mistake to use a simple example to illustrate this. So I apologize. Let's do something. Yes. Sure. Does it have what?
Free acceleration.
Put in the source and the system responds before the source
turns on. You can still make the Green's function causal.
Oh, so you don't necessarily have that?
No, not necessarily. It's the same as in the usual wave equation. You can have a retarded or an advanced solution.
There is a published theory, physical UD, which works for all gauge invariant theories, for all orders.
I believe it.
Why don't you, by me and Richard Wood, why don't you use that theory?
On the next paper I will, I promise.
But here this last one is important because your prescription for this kind of rendition precludes all pre-acceleration and all those famous pathologies that we experience most likely from the initial reaction. It's a higher third order literature you should just do because it's easier than your case. It's just one order, they do the one reduction. They oftentimes still have problems with PX acceleration, and that's because it's not a Markov field. It's a history-dependent process.
Mm-hmm.
And so presumably, I'm just translating all this nice mathematical prescription to the advantages on the physical side.
Yeah.
So presumably, in your prescription, you can actually resolve all these. I'm just making
the
question a little longer.
I'll have to think about that. I'm pretty sure the Green's function is still retarded in this case, but let me, So the less trivial example is the p-adic string theory, and so if you look at fluctuations close to the unstable maximum of the potential, then that's physically meaningful for studying the early stages of brain decay. So you can linearize the equation around this unstable vacuum. And the propagator that you get looks like this, and there are infinitely many poles corresponding to the fact there's an infinite tower of states living close to the unstable maximum, and the zero mode in that tower is negative mass squared state, which is the open string tachyon that you expect to be there, and then you have an infinite tower of complex mass excitations, many of which are ghost-like on top of that, which are the states that you don't want floating around in the theory, and so I would advocate. So if you look at this in Laplace space, then you have two poles on the real axis corresponding to the two data that you need for the tachyon field that you want in the theory, and then you have this infinite series of poles shooting out at sort of 45 degree angles from the axes corresponding to the complex mass states that you don't want in the theory, and the natural sort of choice of prescription is the one that encloses everything, and all of this is meant to be going off to infinity in every direction. And then you might imagine redefining this with a deformed contour that includes the full real axis and the full imaginary axis, and so the two data that you want associated with the tachyon field that you're leaving out, the complex mass states. And it's straightforward to see that this consistently projects out the ghost at the perturbative level, and I'm going to claim that you can do this for that equation at the nonlinear level as well, although from the way I've been arguing this, it's perhaps not obvious.
So maybe I'm confusing myself with the same thing. But your argument, with your prescription, you say that you get solutions that are not the same as if I had started with, let's say, just phi in a local community.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think what you haven't shown is that your with your prescription, the theory is not equivalent to more than one local community.
So another way to do it is to
it could be you have more degrees of freedom.
Maybe to more than one, yeah.
Some constraints on the initial conditions for those degrees of
freedom. Yeah, that may be right. That may be true.
What's the difference between this two?
Between what?
The two things that you said, that, I mean, having more.
It does not, it definitely does not reduce the system to being dynamically equivalent to a single field
right,
with
exactly.
a local kinetic term.
In that case, argument was he started with phi, right, with some non trivial kinetic term for phi. And he said, but look, with my prescription, it doesn't just reduce with, to phi box phi plus local interactions. But it could reduce to phi box phi plus psi box psi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that,
local
yeah.
things and such that. Now, even if you had that system, you would require four units
right.
of data.
No, but there's constraints between there. So in the Lee-Wick case, if you do the multiparticle decomposition on the exercise, I think I skipped that. I had a slide. If you do the multiparticle decomposition on the exercised theory, then in the original picture, it was crucial that the chi-1 and the chi-2 were dynamically independent degrees of freedom. So there's four data for phi, there's two for each of these, so that this multiparticle decomposition has meaning. In the exercise theory, you can still do this, and both of those fields are non-trivial. So it's not equivalent to just turning one of them off. But the reason that it's not unstable now is because there's a dynamical constraint in between those two theories. So if you like, probably the exercised p-adic theory is equivalent to an infinite number of local theories with infinitely many constraints among their dynamics, if you like. But again, I will still say that that's a non-trivial dynamical system. So it's not just the same as setting chi 2 to 0, which is why our inflationary predictions are not the same as the standard case. Yeah, so that's a good point. It's true. So this I already said that.
You can check that by looking at scattering processes satisfy the usual analyticity properties and local quantum field theory. If what you're saying is true, then it is equivalent to a local theory with infinitely degrees of freedom.
Yeah. Yeah, presumably. I was only worried about the stability of the theory. I didn't think about
it.
Yeah.
I can say this because there are no string theory.
Well,
but. Okay, so my understanding is that string theory has infinitely many. Naively, it looks non-local, right? A string is not a local
sure.
object.
Yeah.
But still, you know, perturbative S matrix satisfies usual analyticity properties. So it's still at some level of a local theory.
The non-local string theory is extremely subtle. It's usually
yeah.
seems to be a radical control.
Yeah.
So the only way I can think of it is that somehow string theory has infinitely many degrees of freedom. You know, all of them are somehow.
Well, I mean, it certainly has an infinite number of degrees of freedom. It certainly has an infinite number. There's an infinite color. The perturbative theory has an infinite number. That's
true. You show the scattering apertures of string theory or not? Because when you calculate the scattering aperture and tell the string theory, you find that it's not, you don't get polynomial boundaries. Your paper.
Oh, I
have one comment. So one,
yeah.
one of these goes like Paul marriages with one of the good Pauls.
If you have high order, so it's like box minus m squared and the whole thing squared, then that still induces a ghost. If those poles had been higher order poles, they would have induced ghosts.
Well, if you in the nonlinear level, then in your background, if you these poles start moving, right? Or not?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
So, but do you agree that if you say you have your background is evolving with time, so these poles aren't fixed anymore?
essentially that the mass evolves with time, the position of the poles would be moving around. So at some point, some of these poles may merge.
Yeah, I have to think about that.
Okay. So they're just
yeah. At least at the perturbative level, you construct around the free theory and use perturbative.
Then you have fixed poles. But by the nonlinear theory, I assume poles aren't fixed anymore.
The examples where you actually can solve the nonlinear theory, I haven't tried checking that, but I'll have to think about it. So, I mean, obviously there's a limited number of strong statements you can make about the fully nonlinear problem. So that's.
Let me interrupt you. It shows you a lot of interest in that. If you take covariant scalar field theory and you put fox squared phi, then you can show that when you calculate the perturbation graphs in the momentum space, it propagates a thing that's supposed to make the theory give you finite castles with the vertex, and you end up with the same divergent theory as you. So you have to be very careful about how you separate out the free interaction.
Mm. Yeah.
There's a lot of tricky things.
Sure. Again, we're trying to do cosmology, and it's just single field theory.
He's not trying to construct a finite theory. He's just trying to.
I'm trying to construct an inflationary theory that's stable. Is all.
What you were doing was trying to make your QED finite. Yeah, that's not what you're doing.
There's a secret theory behind it, which is really making all the sensible.
You want to.
Yes.
You want to.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. No, I'm exactly.
You want to do cosmology with a theory, which is has some connection to theory.
Well, it has some connection to string theory, so.
Something you just throw into cosmology, otherwise it becomes totally ad hoc. Okay.
On the first slide.
Sorry, what are you saying, Maxim?
I said, well, this is inflation, and we don't know who is the input on, we don't know what the field phi is, why not shooting, extra stuff with the boxes and...
The motivation was to do that in a way that had some fundamentally different predictions from the usual Kleinsorn thing. Yeah. So, having gotten all that out of the way, we'll try to embed inflation into this sort of generic class of non-local theories, and I'll assume that the potential has an unstable maximum somewhere, and I'll look for inflationary solutions. Where the inflaton is rolling away from that unstable maximum down towards the zero of the potential. And so in the string theory examples that I talked about earlier, this corresponds to looking for inflation during brain decay. I must be way over time, right?
That's okay.
So before I show you how to construct inflationary solutions in this theory, I first want to caution against sort of the naive picture of this. And so naively, you might say, well, during inflation, the field is moving slowly, so its derivatives are small, and the higher derivatives are even smaller than that. And so naively, you would argue, well, it must be a good approximation to just keep the leading term and the expansion of this f of box and throw out the box squared and higher corrections. And if you did this, you would conclude that inflation is only possible when this naive mass scale that appears in the potential here is small compared to the Hubble scale, because that's the thing that keeps the eta parameter small. And of course, that works. That's one way to get inflation in this picture, but it's not the only way to get inflation in this picture. And you can still get slow roll inflation, it turns out, even when this sort of naive eta parameter is very large compared to one. And this is, incidentally, the approach that most models of string cosmology take. So just to give sort of a silly example to illustrate how the dynamics are working, close to the top of the potential, phi is small, so you can imagine throwing out the cubic and higher interactions. And the equation of motion looks like this, and you can obtain solutions by taking phi to be an eigenfunction of box with eigenvalue omega squared, and that solves the full equation as long as omega solves this transcendental equation. So the dynamics of the field are actually being set by the effective mass, which is being derived through the kinetic function and not by the naive mass that's appearing in the mass scale. And the point is that you could imagine scenarios where the effective mass is small, even though the naive mass scale is large. And so this is some mechanism for stretching out the inflaton potential in hilltop inflationary models. So there's two pictures where you can look at this dynamics. On the one picture, you have a very steep potential, and the inflaton feels a strong force pulling it down the hill. But you have this infinite series of high derivative corrections that conspire to slow down its motion despite that steep potential. And on the other hand, as long as you're staying very close to the unstable maximum, then that's completely equivalent to looking at some local field theory where the height of the false vacuum is the same, but now the curvature of the potential has been stretched out by the kinetic energy.
What's going to happen if you try to institute this procedure instead of boxes trying to do, you know, in all orders of perturbation theory, substitute m squared and y squared?
But this is not perturbative in derivatives. It's perturbative about
flattening potential.
Let me, two more slides, and then if I haven't answered it, let me come back. Yeah, so the first example of this is in the case of the p-adic string theory. So the Lagrangian looks like this, and the naive mass scale, which is appearing in the potential, goes like p, and I'll argue that p is typically large, and so the naive mass scale of this scalar field is big compared to one. So naively, you don't expect slow roll dynamics, but the effective mass is just set by the string scale, and it's completely insensitive to p. And so inflation turns out to work in this theory, and if you go through the details, then the Kobe normalization gives you some relation between g-string and p, so that when g-string is sort of order 1, which is kind of the natural thing, then p is something like 10 to the 14, so it's large compared to 1, and you're working deep in the non-local region, which is what I promised before. Moreover, originally I claimed we were trying to construct models that were really high energy inflationary models, and indeed that's true. The Hubble scale is bigger than the string scale during inflation, so the scale of non-locality is actually outside the Hubble horizon. And the dynamics, this sort of slow roll with steep potential thing, you might find surprising, and so you can check all this dynamics using an independent formalism that's non-perturbative in phi, but now it's perturbative in the friction, and so you can use this to double check all the inflationary predictions, and you get the same answers in both approaches. So you can be confident that the dynamics is being correctly described. And so the predictions for the CMB, the spectral tilt is always less than 1, which is good. It's in agreement with the recent WMAP data. The string scale is always well below the Planck scale, which is good because presumably you can sensibly compactify that theory. The tensor modes are undetectably small, which is typical for hilltop inflationary models. And then the interesting thing is non-Gaussianity. M string. Why not?
Because the string scale, g-squared times
Planck
scale.
It depends on the volume, the compactification volume.
Okay, so we're talking about different Planck scale. So which Planck scale? You mean the fundamental or the 40?
The 40.
Okay, that's what you mean.
Which Planck scale? There's only one Planck scale, unless you're
So the original sort of picture I was giving of the dynamics was ignoring the interactions. And of course, everything interesting happens when you start to turn on the interactions. So I'm going to consider the same prototype field theory, non-local theory. I'm going to turn on some qubit coupling with coefficient g. And the interesting thing that happens is as you turn on g, then this correspondence between the local theory with the stretched potential and the non-local theory starts to break down. And you start to get more interesting predictions.
Tell us something about the non-Gaussian energy.
No,
I do. You haven't yet,
no.
Okay, somebody will have to talk about the vacuum fluctuations of the scalar field, then you'll need to do it as a quantum scalar field.
Give me two slides. Yeah. Yeah. I'll show you how we did the perturbation, the cosmological perturbation theory calculation. If that's what you're asking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll show you.
Which involves at some level quantizing.
Yeah. It's just that. Yes. It's just that the action for the free perturbations is just dual to this local theory with the reduced mass, and the it's just the usual Bunch Davies vacuum and the Hankel functions in that regime. Maybe it'll be clearer in a second. Yeah. So before I show you how we calculated this, I just want to sort of heuristically argue why you could expect the non-Gaussianity to be big in a model like this. So clearly, if G is equal to zero, then the perturbations are exactly Gaussian. I'm implicitly ignoring the nonlinearities induced by the gravitational sector when I make this argument. So the three-point function will be vanishing, which so the nonlinearity parameter will also be vanishing. And as you turn on interactions, then the three-point function will be controlled by G, and so also the nonlinearity parameter is controlled by the G, which is a completely trivial statement. I'm just saying the size of the nonlinearity in the theory is controlled by the size of the nonlinear coupling. So clearly, the non-Gaussianity could be made large if the qubit coupling was sufficiently large, and that's a completely trivial statement. I'm just saying the non-Gaussianity is big if it's a strongly interacting field theory. But that would be true in a local model also, but what's not true in a local model is in the local case you can't make G large, because as you make G bigger, you start to make the potential steep and you destroy the slow roll dynamics of the background. But the interesting thing that happens here is I'm not relying on the flatness of the potential to get slow roll inflation. I'm relying on the wonky structure of the kinetic function, and so I can make the interactions in the theory big without screwing up the slow roll dynamics of the background, and I can get big FNL in exactly the same way that just having turned on by hand a big qubit coupling would have given me big FNL. And that sort of, when you present it in that way, it potentially sounds contrived, but it comes out naturally in the p-adic inflation case. This coefficient g turns out to go like p squared, p was something like 10 to the 14, 10 to the 13, and so the coefficient here is naturally going to be really big. So to see how the calculation goes, we can work with a theory where I assume that the kinetic function factorizes like this into the factor that the box minus m squared thing that you would have in a local field theory plus some analytic function with no zeros that encodes the non-local structure. And because this has no zeros and it's analytic, you're allowed to include it in field redefinitions. So I can rewrite this as a theory where the kinetic term has canonical structure, but all the non-local bits have been stuck into the interactions.
How big is this gamma?
What do you mean?
The number.
It's a function.
Right
now this is completely model independent. In the p-adic case, we compute it in the paper. I don't remember the exact.
Is it like 10 to the 5 or something?
It's the point is going to be that once it acts on this function, it gives a large sort of effective coupling.
Okay, so it's not. I cannot think of it as a constant number. I mean, of course.
No, it's not. No. 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 So. When you rewrite things in terms of this field redefinition, then the Gaussian perturbations where you're insensitive to the interaction term are also insensitive to the non-locality of the theory. So clearly this is the best starting point for matching on to the usual cosmological perturbation theory calculation. So the field equation that you get looks like this. In the Gaussian case, you can just throw out the interaction term. So the free field perturbations just evolve according to this equation, which is exactly the thing that you have in the usual local inflationary cosmological perturbation theory calculation. So you know what the solutions here look like. They're just Hankel functions, and you fix the coefficients using Bunch Davies in the usual way. And then everything interesting happens at second order in perturbation theory, where the non-locality manifests itself through source terms for the second order perturbations. So you get some source term that looks like this. I know what the solutions in the free theory look like, so I just need to plug that in and act on it with those pseudo-differential operators and solve for phi 2. And when you go through the algebra of computing this source term, you find that in the interesting regime, it tends to mimic the effect of having turned on a large qubit coupling, and it leads to big FNL in the same way that having turned on a large qubit coupling would have. But again, the novelty here is that doing that doesn't screw up the slow roll dynamics of the background. So you can go through the details, and it's ugly, but it's simplest using this formalism that David Seary et al. Published recently. And the the details here are not important. The point is FNL is proportional to the coefficient of that qubit coupling, and if you plug in the numbers for p-adic inflation, then it turns out that FNL goes like root p, and p can be made extremely large, and so FNL also can be made fairly large, at least in the regime where g-string is close to 1. And as a consistency check, you can look at this calculation in the limit of local field theory, where p goes to 1, and our FNL collapses down to be order of the slow roll.
So this yes? form is, which are the two terms in the bracket dominance? Because if it's the first one, it's a local form.
Yeah, it's close to local.
It's close to local.
Yeah.
So that's what I was thinking. So if it's true that your prescription amounts to having many local fields, then there's one, there's an obvious way in which you could get this even with normal scalar fields. So you're getting a large mass, and yet you're getting slow roll. So that reminds me of the system inflation.
Yeah.
You have many local fields, but somehow together, combined trajectory, it's still slow roll. And you can get large FNL because there you would have many curvature modes.
Is that like
Although we don't.
No, it's not. It's similar. Inflation is in the case of axions, but the
so you have like n fields that.
Yeah, you're basically with n fields, the kinetic term.
That's what I was asking. Yeah. If that gamma is just a large number, then that's.
No, but we really don't have entropy modes in this case, I think, so it's
not.
Why not?
Well, I don't think we do. I'll have to think about that.
Well, the fact that you get local form is very suggestive. It's very suggestive that there are other degrees of freedom which are growing outside the horizon.
Yeah.
That's why you have proportional to n stars. Things somehow are evolving outside the horizon.
Yeah. Although you should remember this, you're thinking of this Kremenelli and Zeldriega stuff, and you should remember that their argument about when you have equilateral and when you have squeeze doesn't apply in this case.
Because
it's not local, we're violating the decomposition. We're violating decoupling because the scale of non-locality is outside the horizon. So the Kremenelli theorem is not. Okay, well, let's talk about that.
Yeah, my seven is just that this, what I was thinking in back of my mind was that if it's really a many local field, then I would expect local FNL. And that's what
I'll have to think about that.
It smell like you have a local theory.
Well, if to the extent that we do, it's infinitely many local theories with infinitely many constraints on them, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
This is why we need a theory, because this would distinguish between Kragaton models and something like that. Whereas if we don't have a theory, so you can have all these different kinds of models which are quite different from one another, saying the same thing.
I would have said the standard minimal inflationary prediction, there's a huge number of models that all give exactly the same NS minus 1, right? But I would have said that FNL is one of the few potentially observable inflationary quantities that you can think about that's relatively model dependent. This is, if we observe FNL bigger than 10, you kill like a huge amount of those models, right? Maybe it does, but what I'm saying is it's a rare observational window that lets you discriminate between inflationary models.
Probably should be easy to look through it with a 4-point function.
In principle, yeah.
You're not using gauge invariant variables or anything complex. You're just perturbing the scale of that.
No, we're perturbing the gravity sector too.
Oh, okay.
That's just to make it easier to see what's going on.
Okay.
The calculation that we do is we perturb the full. We perturb the full thing and construct the Mukhanov variable.
They have infinite poles, right? They're good poles. They are. You still have infinite number options, right?
It's this redefinition thing, right? I'm only including the tachyon pole.
Okay, so there is only one.
Yeah, it's the same. It's the thing when I showed the.
How many poles does the counter include?
Two.
Two poles.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's more than.
There's one. There's two initial conditions now for this system.
You mean like phi and phi dot?
Yeah, just the usual ones. Yeah. Yeah.
So if you said you need an infinite number of derivatives to make it work.
Yeah, so that was the point of this argument that I could deform the contour including a finite number of poles and still have a theory that was fundamentally different from a single derivative theory. Yeah.
What was N star?
It's the number of e-foldings between horizon crossing and the end of inflation. So you can plot FNL as a function of g-string for different values of that number of e-foldings, and the horizontal line is the central value of the recent Yadav and Von Dalt claim detection of FNL. And this is one plus and minus one sigma. And you can see for sort of natural values of the parameters, we reproduce the Yadav and Von Dalt detection, which you can interpret as you like. Maybe because we're running on, I'll just skip to the end. So I would argue the study of these sorts of high derivative theories is well motivated from string theory and from other sort of fundamental theory. This is interesting because it gives you a playground for studying string cosmology to all orders in alpha prime. Or if you don't like string theory, you could just call this a playground for studying UV-complete inflation. When you do this, there are a number of interesting things that happen. You can get slow roll even when naively the potential is extremely steep. You can get large non-Gaussianity, and this is one of the few models that does give large FNL. There's an interesting mathematical structure associated with these kinds of equations, and at the formal level, there's some connections with integral equations and difference equations, and there's a whole literature on this. The outlook would be to sort of attempt to realize this similar phenomenon in more realistic string theory scenarios where you can also stabilize the moduli and where you can worry about standard model and that sort of thing. And with regards to that, the interesting thing is that the effect, the consistency of the field theory and the calculation for FNL are relying on having resummed the full series of high dimension operators. And so this is a example where the CMB is probing some distinctly high energy phenomena. So I'll stop now.
During the last 2 weeks, I've been having, I won't say fierce, but rather heated debate with Richard Wooda about whether infinite derivative or local theories are not unstable. And I claim you can have theories that are not unstable, but he claims that you cannot.
Woodard has exhibited a class of stable non-local theories.
It's really because we went to this 17 years ago.
Yeah, no, I've
now he's changed his tune, and we have papers published, and they say, you can't do this. Besides, you can't prove what you're saying. But it's very hard to, if you know Richard Woodard. Yeah? Even the collaborator, I have trouble with
yeah.
Anyway,
but yeah. So again, my perspective on this is, if you know the theory that you get has these instabilities, but you're still defining it in some sense. If it takes constraints to render it stable, then I get to
You mustn't truncate the derivative.
Yeah, and I agreed with it in the single pole case. Then I'm agreeing with that statement.
So
yeah.
You agree with me, and I'm going to tell Richard. if you need to, be careful.
Yeah, maybe. It's gone now. Yeah, maybe you shouldn't. let's leave me out of this.
You can hear me yelling at you through the
back. So what was your previous slide?
I just wanted to. So a lot of the time. It frequently happens that when I give this talk, people come away with the impression that I'm talking about DBI inflation, because qualitatively there's similarities. There's a bunch of high dimension operators that have derivatives in them, and there's large FNL. And so this was the slide that was convincing, emphasizing for the audience that I'm not talking about DBI. I'm talking about something that's fundamentally different. We have it's different high derivative corrections. We have high powers of Fox, not just high powers of d phi squared. So the equations are. They're not complicated second order equations. They're really fully non-local, fully infinite order equations. And the dynamics are different, and the sound speed is different, and the string theory interpretation is different, and the observations are different.
So is there a limit where PRD gives slow roll inflation predictions? Basically.
Yeah, the limit where you're making those high derivative corrections tiny, right? I mean, because I can go to p equals 1 and just make them go to 0. So I can continuously deform this into a local theory.
Could I also do it in the IR limit, basically, if you have very long wavelength? H is very small, is it the same as making p very
forceful? I think so, yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, I think so.
DBI also has square roots, you don't want cuts.
No, he's just asking if the p-adic reduces to the local prediction. Yeah, they're different. That was the point of this slide. They're just.
Well, our quantum gravity friends have functions that are so like square root 1 minus the box.
Which friends are these?
This is where they argue. This is a couple of cosmic.
Okay, I hadn't followed that. I understand there's some. I had a brief correspondence
with.
Which is
not your case, right? No.
Well, mathematically I can, but I didn't try and do. I mean, I can study initial value problem in that equation if you want. We set up the formalism when Nikki and I did this in the most general possible way. So whatever structure you want, we can handle.
What is your opinion of the landscape? This is just my.
I don't remember if I mentioned that in the talk.
When you were talking before, I was wondering how we would handle perturbations.
Yeah.
Fluctuations.
Yeah.
I thought, well, you'll have to quantize this whole field theory and then handle the fluctuations within that. But I guess you bypass that by going to this field redefinition.
Yeah, exactly. But it's very much analogous to what you do in the usual. I mean, in the usual.
Have you done the other thing?
Presumably, right? But I mean, if you. Yeah, I think so. Well, it must be equivalent to this because you can rewrite it that way. So.
But what is equivalent? I mean, you have to give some well-defined
field theory. Yeah, let me put it this way. In the usual calculation, you perturb the metric and you perturb the field and you have this big messy thing, right? But then you introduce the Mukhanov variable. You know, at first glance, you have no idea how to quantize this. You introduce the Mukhanov variable and you put the constraints back into the action and it ends up just looking like a normal free field theory for the Mukhanov variable. And then you quantize that. The philosophy here is the same thing. I mess around with it until I've reduced it to something that looks like a local free field theory. That's the thing I know how to quantize, and so that's what I do.
There we have a quantum field theory that we thought we understood, at least in flat space. It's completely well defined.
Mm-hmm.
It's not clear that the same is true here. It would be very interesting. I mean, in other words, it seems to me it's an interesting question.
Yeah.
Can this really be made sense of?
Again, my philosophy on this had been the problem with high derivatives to begin with was a classical problem. So if you're going to solve this, you need to solve it at the classical level first. So the argument about evading these instabilities and things was. The problem was classical, and so we're going to solve it at the classical level. And so I don't worry about the quantization that much afterwards. But that's.
Meaning you think it's just takes care of itself and won't be.
Well, I'm being optimistic that it needs to be done, right? We haven't gotten around to it yet. I'm just motivating why we deal with this at the classical level
first.
No,
I understand.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. Results you might get for college.
That's what we're trying to get at with this multi-particle decomposition. So this is in the direction of that, I would think. Anyway, it's.
So what was the field redefinition that Rafa was talking about? I guess you mentioned that at some point. You said you did a field redefinition.
Yeah, I did. Where did I do that?
You had the Calify and
regular. Yeah. Where was it? There it was. Yeah. It's this. So I'm assuming this is analytic and has no zeros. And you know, obviously, if it has zeros, I can't put it in a field redefinition because I'm inducing new states.
So what kind of particles are these fields for example, in the original theory, supposed to be?
In the string theory picture, this is a tachyonic mode living on. It's an open string tachyon living on a brain.
It's a philosophical question. You know, I had such high temperatures when, for example, at the beginning of the universe, the temperature perhaps in dimensions will be perhaps was similar to the gravity constant, no? Or not? At that
time, I'm not sure I understand the question.
It is the inflation at much smaller scale than the Planck scale.
Yes. In this case, for example, the inflation occurred after the Planck scale. Perhaps in the string gas cosmology, the homogeneity problem, I hear that is solved, no? In this sense. For example, the three dimensions, four dimensions appear at a very.
Oh, yeah, I'm not dealing with compactification or anything. It's just. I'm assuming the moduli are stabilized at some high scale and they're not upset by this. So I'm assuming you've already compactified to 4D and you've already stabilized all those moduli at that high scale before inflation starts.
Very good. And the main, for example, these brains appeared from the original
phase. Yeah, they were floating around from. I mean, that's the same approach that people are using in most of these constructions.
Well, in this case, perhaps the thin gas cosmology could not be a good model for. And in this case, you perhaps could use the Dirac as a scalar field, which in the action has only the Lambert field.
I'm just focusing on the tachyon because that's the one where we've studied these high derivative operators. I'm sorry?
It's a question. Why the tachyon is relevant in this stage?
It's the only field I'm in. It's the only one I'm turning on. In principle, everything is.
Well, the dilaton is not also a scalar field?
I'm just freezing it. But yeah. It's a scalar field, but I'm just freezing it by hand. And people have explicit string inflation constructions where they have, you know, stabilized moduli where they have flux compactifications where the dilaton has a mass and all the moduli have big masses, and they can explicitly see that the inflationary dynamics doesn't decompactify the space. So I'm assuming implicitly that something like that has already been done in this context, but we're not. The idea was just to see what the new novel features of the high derivative structure was. So that's sort of a separate.
We are telling the story, a picture, you know, in which you have the string gas for morning, and after the three dimensional spatial, five, for example, no?
Yeah.
And in this case, for example, after supposing a mass appeared by a breaking of symmetry, the dilaton perhaps could become a kind of quintessence, the thermal energy, perhaps giving a kind of. If not needed inflation in a string gas, so homogeneous is separate. This problem is not needed. You can go.
I'm not that familiar with the string gas picture.
Making the double sum in is really problematic. Mm-hmm. It's going to make all your couples. Right?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. Also, if the dilaton is at high scale.
Generally speaking, you want the double sum.
Yeah.
We'll make the input out of something.
Thank you.
Thank you. Neil again.